Following are comments on Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act 5. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio. Hamlet meets a witty grave digger and muses on the universality of death, until Ophelia's much-reduced funeral procession arrives. In Act 5, Scene 1, we arrive at the famous gravedigger scene, which, in terms of the play's structure, is sandwiched between the announcement of Ophelia's death and the violent deaths of Hamlet's main characters in Act 5, Scene 2. This vignette in the churchyard serves as comic relief, of course, but it also gives us and Hamlet himself a broader perspective on what has happened so far. The gravedigger calmly goes about his business, which is death itself, since everyone will one day need his services. Some of his jests, says the Norton editor, refer to an actual law case concerning suicide. Hales v. Pettit, 1558. The names are spelled H-A-L-E-S and P-E-T-I-T. We will get no maudlin meditations from the gravedigger. He's full of riddles and legal fine points. Social historians have noted that a lively interest in legal cases and terminology was common among ordinary people in Shakespeare's time, just as it is today, thanks in part to all those Law and Order TV spin-offs. Anyhow, the crux of the gravedigger's argument, as drawn from the law case mentioned above, is, quote-unquote, if the man go to this water and drown himself, it is willy-nilly he goes, mark you that. But if the water come to him and drown him, he drowns not himself. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 15 through 17. That seems like a humane conclusion for Ophelia's case, since, if we follow Gertrude's description, Ophelia did not, quote-unquote, go to the brook and drown herself. She seems to have clutched a branch that broke, and then, in a state of madness, to have fallen into the brook. After this discussion, the gravedigger sings and tosses up a skull. This act spurs Hamlet's philosophical musings on the universality of death. The skull, so casually tossed up and aside, becomes a memento mori object, common in medieval and early modern times. Hamlet conjectures that the skull, quote-unquote, might be the pate of a politician or a courtier. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 70 through 71. Another skull is thrown to the surface, and Hamlet wonders if it might be, quote-unquote, the skull of a lawyer. If it is, quote-unquote, where be his quiddities now, his quillets, his cases, his tenures, and his tricks? Why does he suffer this mad knave now to knock him about the sconce with a dirty shovel, and will not tell him of his action of battery? Act 5, Scene 1, lines 89 through 92. Hamlet's questions compel us to admit that the law's fine points, its emphasis on procedures and rules and court decorum, its concerns for the minutiae of property deeds, etc., matter not a whit when the lawyer dies. At least, not to him. Soon, the gravedigger tosses up yet another skull, and with a bit of prompting, Hamlet recognizes the identity. It's the skull of Yorick, Hamlet Sr.'s court jester when the prince was a little boy 23 years ago. At the sight of this skull, Hamlet turns sad, quote-unquote, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 166 through 167. Hamlet's loving childhood memories confront his nausea at the ugly sight of a skull, and he admonishes any fine lady at her cosmetics table that her efforts are nil. Quote unquote, to this favor she must come. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 174 through 175. What happened to Yorick, Alexander the Great, and Julius Caesar will happen to her. It was a medieval saying that life is loan, and Greek and Roman Stoicism and Epicureanism were developed in part to allay the fear of death. Nobody ever went broke trading on this fear. Still, as others have pointed out, Hamlet's confrontation with death has a certain freshness, as if he really is facing this fact of life for the first time. Perhaps it's always like that. The shock of death never quite wears off, so that every earnest consideration of it seems like the first. Hamlet's meditations end abruptly when he and Horatio see a funeral procession, truncated to support only maimed rites, coming towards the burial grounds. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 198. Hamlet and Horatio stand to one side to avoid detection, and Laertes begins wrangling with the priests. Why is Ophelia being carried to her burial with so little ceremony? The priest's reply is that, quote-unquote, her death was doubtful. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 206. Laertes responds with scorn, and Hamlet realizes that the body is Ophelia's. Gertrude addresses the departed Ophelia with evident sincerity, saying, quote-unquote, sweets to the sweet, farewell. I hoped thou shouldst have been my Hamlet's wife. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 222 through 223. She has scarcely had the time to utter these words when there ensues a bit of graveside theater of the absurd, or bad reality TV, an outrageous contest between Laertes and Hamlet over who loved Ophelia more. In most editions of Hamlet, at least one of the men, Laertes, actually jumps into her grave. This is not how Hamlet meant to reveal himself to the king, but events have got the better of him, so he vents. The two men have ruined Ophelia's funeral as thoroughly as if they'd both spent 3 days planning to do exactly that. It's one final, if unpremeditated, insult to the hapless Ophelia. What has Hamlet learned from his brief sojourn in the graveyard, and indeed by means of some of his experiences in Act 4? He now fully appreciates that the earthly prize of a kingdom, of reputation, of a patch of land that one may go or be sent to fight for, is a thing more to be mocked than contended for. Thanks to the gravedigger and Yorick's skull, Hamlet has confronted the universality of death earnestly, and the death of Ophelia has reinforced the melancholy realization. Why does all this matter? Perhaps because if Hamlet's revenge is to be accomplished, it can only happen when his mind isn't tainted by pride, anger, or earthly attachment. Hamlet is not merely a romantic dreamer or a distant intellectual, but he is a peculiar kind of revenger, and his meditation on death is vital. Why, indeed, should we cling to life? And why should we try to control the outcomes of our actions? These are questions that Hamlet is able to ask now in a manner that the to be or not to be soliloquy in Act 3, Scene 1, also addressed brilliantly, but on a more abstract level. In the final scene, we will see Hamlet facing these big questions in a more effectual way. There's a divinity that shapes our ends. Even as control over his predicament seems to be slipping away, Hamlet accomplishes his revenge against Claudius. In Act 5, Scene 2, Hamlet, taking Horatio back to his time aboard a ship on the way to England and his death, relates his impatience to know the quote-unquote grand commission of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Act 5, Scene 2, Line 18. In searching and finding what he sought, Hamlet tells Horatio, he learned an important lesson, quote-unquote, our indiscretion sometimes serves us well when our deep plots do fall, and that should learn us there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will. Act 5, Scene 2, Lines 8 through 11. This known, namely, his head is to be parted from his trunk as soon as he arrives, Hamlet forges a new commission requesting that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern be executed in England, without time for Christian shriving. Many critics view Hamlet's rashness in stabbing Polonius as a fault. It's what led Claudius to pack him off to England for immediate execution, but the prince does not see things that way. He now sees that awful incident as providential to a degree that he could not appreciate at the time. He also calmly justifies to a shocked Horatio the lethal trick he played on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. In the 1623 folio, Hamlet says dismissively, quote unquote, "Why, man, they did make love to this employment," and continues, quote unquote, "They are not near my conscience. Their defeat does by their own insinuation grow. 'Tis dangerous when the baser nature comes between the pass and fell incensed points of mighty opposites." Act 5, Scene 2, line 56.1, lines 57 through 61. In the grand struggle between Hamlet and Claudius, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are insignificant, and the absurdity of their fate seems weirdly appropriate. Hamlet also brings up a new motive to Horatio. Quote unquote, "He that hath killed my king and whored my mother has also," quote unquote, "popped in between the election and my hopes." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 64 through 65. Claudius's hasty marriage has deprived Hamlet of the throne. The Oedipal significance of these statements is that Claudius has come between Hamlet and Gertrude. Hamlet accepts Osric's fencing match offer, saying to Horatio, quote unquote, "We defy augury. There is special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 191 through 194. See also Matthew chapter 10, verse 29, and Luke chapter 12, verse 7. This match is not of Hamlet's making, but he will accept the outcome. On a providential view, Hamlet's reliance on the significance and order implicit even in, quote unquote, the fall of a sparrow, may be the insight, the right attitude that he has been in search of. The phrase right attitude is a Buddhist concept we might import for its resonance. The prince must not be an agent of vengeance for his own part, or even on his father's say-so, but an instrument of God's vengeance. This may be so if, that is, we choose to accept such a reading and do not consider it perhaps a bit too convenient or even facile. We might recall that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, although willing to bend the knee to an earthly ruler's designs, nonetheless went to their deaths as instruments of forces larger than they could imagine. So, in an ironic sense, they have shown Hamlet the way. In the end, Claudius's insidious plan is frustrated, and his union with Gertrude is nullified when she drinks the poisoned wine, responding, quote unquote, "I will, my lord," to Claudius's feeble, quote unquote, "Gertrude, do not drink." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 267 through 268. There's an Augustinian lesson to be drawn from this. The wicked will find a way to destroy themselves. They are consistent in their patterns of evil. See also Gerard Manley Hopkins' sonnet, "I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day," which ends, quote unquote, "I see the lost are like this, and their scourge to be as I am mine, their sweating selves, but worse." Hamlet gains no earthly reward but death for his takedown of Claudius and Laertes, the latter of whom at least reconciles with the prince. With his final breaths, Hamlet checks Horatio's impulse to commit suicide and lays upon him the burden of preserving his quote-unquote, wounded name. Act 5, Scene 2, line 322. Horatio is to tell Hamlet's story, since the dying prince says to him, quote-unquote, report me and my cause aright to the unsatisfied. Act 5, Scene 2, lines 317 through 318. In the wake of the old order's self-destruction, Fortinbras and other listeners will hear from Horatio of, quote-unquote, purposes mistook, fallen on the inventor's heads. Act 5, Scene 2, lines 362 through 363. This will in no way give Denmark's new ruler the full story, but it will have to do. That's a point made by Marjorie Garber in her commentary on Hamlet in Shakespeare After All, Vintage 2005. The conclusion of Hamlet seems to be partly classical. Hamlet's concern for his name and reputation is as strong as that of his father, and the afterlife is essentially what people say about a person after he or she has died. In the end, Hamlet is not so different from the imperious dead father to whose honor he dedicated the last part of his short life. That same honor is in part what Horatio will be relating to the brand new king, young Fortinbras, and the rest of the court. As soon as young Fortinbras marches in, accompanied by his guards and a couple of English ambassadors, he is curious to learn what dreadful thing has happened at Elsinore. He has arrived in the wake of the Danish royal order's self-destruction, and the kingdom is his. Although the young man refrains from gloating, he is, of course, reversing the defeat of his own father at the hands of Hamlet's much-revered warrior father, Hamlet Sr. There is no question of Fortinbras as being a superior ruler. He's a lucky opportunist, an outcome that scarcely amounts to a purification of the state of Denmark, if that was the play's objective. Finally, whatever cast we may put upon Hamlet, it is a curious revenge tragedy in that it denies, or at least downplays, agency with regard to the character who is responsible for ensuring that the play's villain gets what he deserves. And yet, the revenge gets itself accomplished. In his 1998 commentary on Hamlet in Shakespeare and the Invention of the Human, published by Riverhead Books, Harold Bloom suggests that Hamlet, the most enigmatic of tragic characters, overflows the production that hosts him. His subjectivity is more complex than even a sophisticated drama such as Hamlet can absorb or use to get its action performed. Aristotle wrote nearly two millennia before Shakespeare's time that in tragedy, plot is the most important element, followed by character. It's hard to conjure a play that more thoroughly turns that dictum on its head. Faced with the productive difficulty of a bad fit between the hero's excessive capacities and an action that needs completing, it's no wonder that Shakespeare chose to end the play with an unsettling mixture of comic absurdity and military gravity. Flummoxed, the English ambassador declares, quote-unquote, the ears are senseless that should give us hearing, to tell him his commandment is fulfilled, that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Act 5, Scene 2, lines 347 through 349. Fortinbras, for his part, honors Hamlet, ordering that, quote-unquote, for his passage, the soldiers' music and the rite of war speak loudly for him. Act 5, Scene 2, lines 376 through 378. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Monday, February 9th, 2026. The foregoing material is copyright 2026 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.